I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, 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 welcome to Playboys episode 7. As everyone knows, the first thing you think of when you think Shakespeare is funky music, so we have our funky music intro. I'm Dean, as always. I'm joined today not by PJ, but by Alex. Hello, Alex.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
No problem. Do you want to give us the quick, like, 20, 30 second, you know, you've done some stuff with Shakespeare before, right?
Yes. So, unlike you, I have not touched the histories at all, but I have watched and read every comedy and tragedy at least once. So yeah.
Cool. And you did some acting, am I right?
Yeah. So I acted in Coriolanus before. I acted in Twelfth Night. I think there might be another one, but I forget. Did some Greek plays. Yeah.
Nice. And you did a ranking of Shakespeare's comedies. So you're not coming into this with no idea what you're talking about. You've probably got better history on Shakespeare than I do, actually. So I've never acted, you know?
I forgot a lot of my history, to be honest. But I did take notes for today.
Good. Why don't you tell us then, which play are we doing today?
So we are doing Measure for Measure. And I think this is the perfect time for us to be discussing it because it was first performed in 1604 on Christmas.
Ah, I didn't know that, actually. There we go. So it's seasonally appropriate. I can see why this one would be done for Christmas, actually, because it's really? A little bit silly. It's a little bit lighthearted. Nothing too much, you know.
I mean, I think we should then discuss like how this is considered a problem play then. So you say like it's funny, lighthearted. Really?
Well, okay, there's definitely some problems as it goes along. I'm not saying there's nothing, but I mean, I guess I'm just saying it lacks tragedy, you know what I mean? It's lighthearted enough for Christmas in the sense that it's not giving us, you know, the kind of tragedy you get in like Romeo and Juliet or Hamlet or something, you know, it is comedy, essentially.
To an extent. We probably won't be discussing it, but there might be some tragedy with Isabella later on.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly some problems, and we can get into that.
But yeah, it is a dark comedy, which I really enjoyed about it.
Yeah, I think, I guess my point is just, you know, it's comedy enough that you can get away with this for Christmas, you know? I certainly wouldn't be doing a Christmas presentation of, you know, Henry VI, part 324, because that's very dry, you know?
I mean, you're right. So, it is a comedy in the sense that it does end with several marriages and no important deaths.
Yeah, pretty much. I suppose that's the point I try to make. So we'll get into it in a minute. It's set in Vienna. Now, I think I always hear people say like, oh, you know, maybe Shakespeare's plays weren't really by him because they're set in places he was never in. I think with this play, I mean, the fact that it's in Vienna is not really strictly important. Like, he could have set this anywhere, you know, change the names around a little bit, but I don't think it gets a lot into, you know, the culture in Vienna or anything. Like, I think it's fine.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the characters. We've got the Duke, Vincentio Knight. And again, one of the reasons it's a comedy is because we have a lot of false identity, dressing up, disguise kind of thing, which is quite typical in comedies. The Duke's deputy, Angelo, who is, I believe, also his cousin, some kind of relative, that he leaves in charge while he goes away. And then there's Escalus, who, well, my notes say, you know, the dramatis personae is an ancient lord, but essentially he's just the other guy at court. So he's, you know, offering his opinions and helping with decision-making, you know?
Yeah, when Angelo says, I'm just going to leave this to you, he's like, Angelo's deputy in a way.
Essentially, yeah. He's the deputy. And I suppose our main chap is the young gentleman, Claudio. Now, tell us, what does Claudio do wrong? Because the whole place is surrounding the fact that Claudio commits a supposed crime.
Yes. So I had to look into like what the actual crime was. And so he was to be married to, what's her name? Not Mariana. I actually forgot.
it was a Juliet, actually.
Juliet. Sure. Yeah. So he was meant to be married to Juliet, but he got her pregnant before they were officially married. Now, they had already technically said their vows is what it seemed like, but they never got the dowry. And so they were never then married in the church's eyes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's arrested for getting her pregnant before being married.
And it's such a strange thing because, you know, this was very consensual. There's no accusations that he forced himself on her or anything like that. Yeah. They both want to get married. I don't really know why this was a problem, you know, and I understand stricter laws, but truly just let them get married. Don't arrest him, you know.
I don't know if I would actually say Claudio is the main guy. I would say the Duke is, because he's in more scenes than Claudio.
Yes, the Duke appears more. I suppose I'm saying this story centers around Claudio, but he's more of an absent main character in that sense, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't actually see him.
Then, like, the Duke says that he's going to go abroad. I think he said it was going to be, like, Hungary or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, they kind of name a few places throughout the play.
He was going to go abroad, but... Well, really, the reason he wants to go abroad is he thinks that he's been a little bit too lax with the laws. And so he says, look, let's get someone to, you know, I don't know why he didn't tighten them up himself, but maybe he didn't want to affect his reputation with the people. Not really sure. But he says, I'm going to leave Angelo in charge and he can tighten up on the laws. And, you know, then I'm not going to be the bad guy, essentially.
Yeah. And that's what was really interesting to me, because I feel like you can go through this the first time and think, oh, the Duke's a really good guy. He's like trying to catch Angelo in the act or something. No, he's the one who's put Angelo up to doing this, because he does think that the laws are too lax.
Yeah, pretty much, you know, he's left him with the instruction to tighten up on the laws. You know, that's what Angelo does. Technically, whether we agree with it or not, technically Claudio did commit a crime, you know. And sure, we see similar things later where the Duke just kind of says to people, well, sure, just get married, like that fixes the problem. But actually the Duke had left Angelo with the instruction to tighten up on the laws, so that's why he doesn't say, well, then just get married and fix the problem. He deals by the letter of the law, you know.
Yeah.
So he's the bad guy, but, you know, he's got the Nuremberg defense, right? He was following orders, essentially.
Fair enough. Yeah, yeah. So the Duke, I wonder if, like, the Duke is supposed to go through this, like, I'm thinking, like, as a character, like, an actor playing this character, like, are you supposed to see, like, go through and say, like, hey, this is, this is too lax. I want to make it stricter. And then you look at Angelo, it's like, oh, that's a little too strict. We need to backpedal a little bit here.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. But then, I mean, Angelo does some shady stuff later. So I don't want to be painting the impression here that I'm a fan of Angelo's. I'm not.
Oh, no.
But, you know, in terms of the initial act one kind of stuff, the problems with Claudio, he was doing what he was expected of him, really, you know?
Yeah.
What other characters do we have? We have Lucio, who's listed here as a fantastic. As far as I can tell, Lucio's job is just to kind of go around and sort of faff about and, you know, stir up trouble and just mess around, really.
I love this character. So, I mean, I didn't care about him the first time, but going through and, like, seeing how he talks with the Duke, that's the only time I actually like him. But whenever he's talking with the Duke's just like, shut up, you insolent little boy. Like...
Yeah, I mean, pretty much. He's insolent. That's his entire character type.
And Lucio, of course, he doesn't know that the monk is the Duke, so he'll talk badly about the Duke, and Duke's like, oh, go on. Well, I'm going to get revenge on this guy later, but yeah, tell me more.
Yes, so basically Lucio's entire, you know, existence in the play boils down to... He crops up once or twice, but his main thing is when the Duke's disguised as a friar, he badmouths the Duke a lot. And then later, when the Duke's back and the friar's gone, badmouths the friar for badmouthing the Duke. And then when he realizes the Duke is the friar, it's kind of like, ah, crap.
I don't know if it's not said until Act 5, but the friar's name is Lodowick.
Yeah, they mentioned like briefly in you're right, in Act 5. It's not really mentioned, I don't think, when he first appears.
Yeah, kind of confusing later on. But yeah, I mean, Lucio, however you want to pronounce it, he basically has one main action, I would say, throughout the play. So he's the one who goes and gets Isabella from the convent, the nunnery.
I'm
not entirely sure. But she's a sister training to be a nun. And so she hears that Claudio is going to be executed in a couple days. And so Lucio then goes and persuades her, like, hey, can you come and talk to your brother and maybe talk to Angelo? Because it's really hard for men to say no to women.
Yeah, that seems to be the supposition that they work with. But yeah, you're right. That's, other than bad-mouthing the Duke, that's Lucio's other action in the play. You know, he is a minor character, essentially. So he does those two things. And that one is integral to the plot, I suppose. There's some things that happen, though, that are not integral to the plot. So if we look at the minor characters, we have a provost. That's fine. His job is just to kind of bring people in around to the jail and things like that. We have two other friars, which adds a little bit of complication, but it's manageable. And then we have a constable, Elbow, a foolish gentleman, Froth, and a clown. And then there's the executioner and things like that. There's some scenes with Elbow and the clown and Froth. These don't add anything to the play, do they? These are nonsense.
Elbow is supposed to add just a little bit of comic relief, but Froth is there for like one scene, and he's to do with like the brothels and... I think I basically skipped that scene. Like,
yeah,
I skimmed through it. Like, is there anything important? And then, nope, nothing really happened.
There's not. Yeah, they just pop up, you know, maybe two or three times. As you say, Froth himself is in at once. But there's just two or three little comedy scenes, you know, with the clown and things. And now he's talking to Elbow. Now he's talking to Escalus, whatever it is. But they're just... they're irrelevant. Like, they don't affect the story in any way. And if we look quickly then at the female characters, we have obviously Claudio's sister, Isabella. We have Juliet, the beloved of Claudio. We don't really see much of her, but she's just, we need to be aware that she is there.
Yeah, she might have like one or two lines. It's just pregnant woman on stage, and that's basically...
Yeah, essentially. Yeah. She's not really a major role. And we have Mariana. Now, Mariana was the betrothed of Angelo, and I guess due to some issues with the diary, he jilted her. And this was a number of years, 5 years ago or something, I think they say. So it was a while back. So, and we have Mistress Overdone.
Oh, yes.
An amazing
name. Another one. So, she is head of the brothel.
Head of the brothel.
She doesn't do a lot, but she does then say some things that the Duke then overhears about, like, Lucio getting a girl pregnant. And so the Duke's like, oh, I can get back at Lucio for this. Great. Save that one away for later.
Yes. She saves that one up. Because we find out that Lucio did get a girl pregnant, a prostitute, as he says. And again, curiously, that's very easily fixed by making him marry her. So I don't know why the whole thing with Claudio has to happen, but look, there we go. So let's look at the beginning. So Act 1 is easy, because I think we've almost covered what happens in Act 1, which is we start with Vincentio the Duke explaining that he's going to go away and leave Angelo in charge. So that's kind of a big part of it. And we have the early stuff with Claudio. We obviously find out that he has... you know, had relations with a woman that he's technically not quite yet married to, even though it's very, very clear they're going to get married. And this, you know, this obviously causes a problem and he's going to be arrested. And of course, we go to the nunnery then. And as you correctly say, they send Lucio to get Isabella and basically say, you know, you're about to take your vows. I've caught you just in the nick of time. Don't take the vows. Come back and help your brother. So that's essentially, you know, what happens in Act 1.
Yes. Although Claudio takes it surprisingly well, he's just like, oh, I've been unlucky. God chooses who he gives mercy to, but I wasn't one of them. That sucks.
That's it. Yeah. Pretty much. And I mean, I've got to quote a little bit here. He says, thus stands it with me upon a true contract. I got possession of Julietta's bed. So he's saying he did things kind of, not necessarily in line with the laws. He admits it was a mistake, but with good intention, you know. I got possession of Juliet's bed. You know the lady, she is fast my wife, save that we do the denunciation lack of outward order. This we came not to, and he goes on about the diary. You know, so that's him saying, you know, we have a marriage contract, essentially. We have this agreement in principle. But then, you know, I suppose by the letter of the law, if I have an agreement in principle to buy something from you, but then I don't kind of follow through with part of that, you know, I have broken that. So it's still, he's still committed a crime, essentially, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there still could be intention to follow through in the future, but there is that kind of gray area. I do like that you chose that one. I also chose, I like that you chose that quote because it's a very important one throughout the play. I kind of like one, a different one that's similar, but more for the joking side.
Okay.
So it says, it's in Act 1, Scene 4. So that from the seedness, the bear fallow brings to teeming Foison. Even so, her plenteous womb expresseth his full tilth and husbandry, which I saw translated as her body shows the results of his plowing.
Wow. I don't know which is worse, actually, the original or the modern translation. Both of those are pretty rough.
I love it. I mean, these jokes just come throughout, and it is like the dark sexual humor. If you're doing this for A-levels, like it is a bit more adult maybe than what you've normally heard in most of your schooling.
It is. And, you know, there is a reason why if anyone listens to the most recent Books Boys, I talked about an Orwell book and a very, very small subplot is the school bans Shakespeare because they think it's adult material. You know, there is a reason for that. There is a little bit of adult stuff going on in this play.
Oh, yeah. Drink this prune juice and you can get rid of your syphilis, like that type of stuff.
Yeah. And we kind of close out, I suppose, Act One. With well, we know what's happened with Claudio, but Isabella and Lucio, when they talk at the convent, and Isabella just says, well, let him marry her, you know, that's the simple solution, right? And Lucio explains, this is the point, the Duke is very strangely gone from hence, for many gentlemen, myself being one in hand and hope of action, blah blah blah. But basically what he says is the Duke is gone, governs Lord Angelo, a man whose blood is very snow broth, one who never feels the wanton stings and motions of the sense. And he goes on to essentially explain, we need to soften Angelo because he's quite hard. But again, I think that it does Angelo a bad turn when this is what was expected of him. This is why he's in charge, is to be harsh.
Yeah, exactly. So I sort of feel bad for Angelo here at this point.
In this initial stage, yes.
Yeah. We'll get to that a little bit more later.
And you're right. I mean, I saw Claudio as the main character. I'm going to make a... He disappears basically after Act One because he's arrested, you know. So although the plot centers around him, he's no longer actually appearing. So you're right to say that then the Duke then essentially becomes the main character. But we open Act Two with just a lot of nonsense, really, with Elbow and Clowns and Escalus and just an extended scene of irrelevancy, I would say.
Yeah, I wrote a little bit down for it. So it seems that, like, yeah, Escalus and Provost, they do actually pity Claudio. They think that Angelo is being a bit too strict. But Angelo comes in with kind of some interesting philosophy, I'd say. Basically, he says, well, Claudio was stupid enough to get caught. So, I mean, we could just say, like, arrest everyone and just try to find something bad that they've done, but if it's not noticed, then it's fine. And so, like, I have a quote here, the jury passing on the prisoner's life, may in the sworn 12 I have a thief or two, guiltier than him they try. What's open made to justice, that justice seizes. What knows the laws, that thieves do pass on thieves.
Mm-hmm.
So even people in the jury can be guiltier than the person that they're judging.
Which, I mean, I suppose could happen in any trial, you know. That's just something you ought to deal with, I guess. But you still have to, you know, deal by the laws. And even the Duke says, you know, we have very strict laws. We've just let them sleep for 14 years. So, you know, so he's trying to do something right here, in a sense.
The Duke actually agrees with Angelo as well. He's like, yeah, you can say that as long as you don't have those issues yourself. So you can be as strict as you want to be as long as you yourself are perfect.
Yeah, and I suppose in a sense that's fair, right? You don't be a hypocrite. Angelo's a hypocrite, though.
Yes. So that brings us to Act 2, Scene 2. Isabella comes to plead for Claudio's life.
Yeah, pretty much. We've gone right to where we want to be here. We're in Act 2, Scene 2. Angelo, this is where we don't like Angelo anymore. So he basically says, I mean, I don't know if you want to draw this out anymore, but the summary version is, he basically says, yes, he's condemned to die. I'm not going to release him. Oh, however, if you were to sleep with me, then I will release him because you're a, you know, a pretty chaste virgin and whatever. So if you give up your body to me, I will release, you know, the body of your brother. Essentially, it's, you know, one for one.
Exactly.
At this point, we're not big fans of Angelo anymore. But the thing is, at the time of this play, I'm not sure how seriously that would have been seen, you know.
Yeah, it's not even, well, it is blackmail, but it's also just like, you do this for me, I'll do this for you.
Yeah, and I worry that, you know, obviously nowadays we're living in a modern world, we've had our Me Too and all that kind of stuff. Back then, I wonder if, sure, I guess you can see that Angelo's meant to be the villain, but I don't think they would have seen it almost as severely as we're looking at it now. You know, I think they would have thought, well, it's, you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours kind of thing. And sure, it's still a mean thing to do, but I don't think they would have seen like the kind of moral repercussions that we would see in it today. And we have to be aware of that, I guess.
I mean, I can see that to an extent, but then also on the other hand, they do really feel that like virginity is a thing that you really must protect it. You have to really take care of these young women and don't let them sleep with any man, right?
Yeah.
So, like, I can see them also being like, oh, yeah, we can't let this guy touch her. She's too pure.
Yeah, so, sorry, I should elaborate. They would see it as serious, but, like, for a different reason. I don't think they see it as serious because he's sexually blackmailing her. Yes. They see it as serious because a virgin shouldn't, you know, have sex with anyone, essentially. Which is, you know, if I was Isabella and I thought, oh, by having sex with this guy, I can save the life of my sibling, that wouldn't, you know, I'd be like, well, I'm going to do that then. I'm going to help my sibling. Whereas for her, it's a big, big, serious thing. So it's almost flipping the guilt the wrong way. That's what I don't like. You know, it's almost like the problem is her virginity, not the sexual blackmail, you know?
Exactly, exactly.
So that's just, you know, it's something to be aware of, I guess, and how we see it versus maybe how it would have been seen at the time. And I think that's where the play does, you know, you mentioned it's a dark comedy. There's the darkness.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, even the jokes that come throughout can also be pretty dark as well. They do joke throughout some of these dark moments.
Yeah, they do. And again, we have it every now and again. We have comic relief with the clowns and things that pop up. So how do we go then after that? So how do we go through the rest of Act 2? Isabella obviously then has her prolonged discussion with Angelo. She's not really up for it. You know, it seems at one point that she's considering it. And then she's kind of like, actually, no, this is too, you know, too serious for me. I don't want to save the body of my brother at the expense of my own soul. Because, you know, it's a wrong thing for her to do, essentially. So she decides, well, I guess Claudio's got to die then.
You know, yeah.
That's what I mean. A sister today wouldn't probably do that. You know, you wouldn't actually let your brother die nowadays, but there we go. She, the seriousness of, you know, the impure virgin was too much for her, essentially.
Yeah. She says, better it were a brother died at once than that a sister, by redeeming him, should die forever.
Yes, that is an amazing quote. Just like the gradual kind of the loss of her soul and then, you know, just continuing her life as a broken kind of person. And that's a very powerful quote, I think.
Yeah, Act 2, Scene 4 just has some really good back and forth. And like, she even tells him like, hey, I'm going to tell people about you blackmailing me. And then Angela says, okay, go ahead. No one's going to believe you. And then I'll also just torture Claudio to death. Not even do it quickly.
Yeah. So this is where we really start to not like Angela then, because he gets worse. You know, it's not enough that he does the, you do something for me, I'll do something for you. It's then, oh, but then if you try to tell anyone about this, then I'll do lots of other bad things, you know? So it kind of, at this point, I think the villainy does shine through a little bit more, you know.
Yes. And then I think it takes us to the key point of the entire play. Basically, this is the bed trick. Is this when that comes up?
Yeah, they start to talk about the bed trick. So this was difficult for me again. And this is something that I think maybe contemporary, you know, Shakespeare's contemporaries might not have even thought much of a big deal. And that's scary. But the Duke essentially says, well, we know about this girl, Mariana, that that Angelo was in love with. And this is kind of as we go through Act 3, they talk about it in Act 4. They go to meet Mariana then.
Was he in love with her? I think it was more that he was just betrothed.
Well, yeah, okay.
Because he wanted any out that he could get, it seems, when that dowry didn't show up and her brother died at sea.
Yeah, I think he was, quote, in love with her on the condition that it was actually benefiting him. You know, and then once he wasn't getting the diary and things, but they basically decide, you know, really, you should have married her. So we're going to try to fix that. And now they basically say that if he has sex with Mariana, that will be enough to consider that they should get married. And then that raises the point. Well, then why didn't Claudio just do that in the first place? And we didn't need the play. But, you know, there we go. So.
Yeah, fair enough.
So now they do. Is it fair to say they essentially plan? Is it fair to say they're going to rape Angelo? Like, I feel like that's kind of what's happening here.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, they plan to rape them, basically.
And yeah.
This is seen as a good thing in two of Shakespeare's plays. This one here and All's Well That Ends Well.
Yeah.
So it's just so that these people can be married.
All's Well That Ends Well, but like I don't consider that to be ending well, you know, but that apparently it was considered okay. Probably. Yeah, yeah. So essentially we're being about the bush here, but basically what they do is they say Angelo wants to have sex with Isabella, so why don't we bring in Mariana, let him think it's Isabella, just trick him, essentially. And, you know, there we go. Once he's had sex with Mariana, we say, well, now you've got to fulfill those ancient obligations that you had to marry her, and all's well, essentially. But they've done that through, because, you know, nowadays we would consider that kind of mistaken identity deliberately caused to essentially be tantamount to raping Angelo. But I think back then they thought it was a bit of a chuckle, really, which is, you know, quite worrying.
Because it's done to a man, right?
So that's something to be aware of. And, you know, maybe there's that part of them that says, well, Angelo is the bad guy here. He's getting his comeuppance in a sense, but it doesn't sit well with me. I think it's quite difficult for, I don't want to say like an enlightened modern reader, but I think with the moral culture of today, that struck me as quite a lot more severe than I think it would have done even in recent history, never mind in Shakespeare's day, you know?
Yeah.
So should we talk a little bit about the Duke? Because he, you know, he is present throughout. He's dressed as this friar, and at times I wonder what he's doing, you know. He wants to see what's happening with Angelo whilst he's pretending that he's left. So he says, off I go, puts on a disguise. Somehow no one can tell it's him because he's wearing a hood. And, you know, then he goes around chatting with her. We talked about him chatting to Lucio. He chats with Isabella. He hatches this rape plan, essentially. Is it a little bit unrealistic that no one can recognize him just because he's kind of got his face partially covered with a hood? Or is that...
Well, that's the thing. Like, throughout most of the play when I watched it, like, his hood was down.
So right.
No one just seems to know what the Duke looks like. They just know, hey, there's this Duke. Or there's also the idea, it's like the Clark Kent Superman type idea. Like
change you know, some small details about the clothing and you'll not know who it is, essentially.
Yeah. And it's kind of like, oh yeah, there's no way it could be the Duke, right?
Yeah.
Like the Duke wouldn't ever look like that. So you're also like trying to make yourself believe these certain things.
Yeah, this friar just magically appears and, you know, no one seems to think anything strange. At the same time, the Duke disappears and they look very alike. I guess you just, you know, sometimes you've just got to want it, right? You just got to want to suspend your disbelief and to go along with the story. It's not really important. It just struck me as slightly amusing.
That's why at the end, I think, not to give any spoilers, but the Duke shows up, then disappears and dresses back up as the friar. But when he yes. does that again, he does put his hood up so that no one actually sees, like, because it's been too recent for them to forget his face.
So maybe you're right. Maybe like a lot of them just wouldn't have known what he looked like in the first place. You know, why would these random people necessarily know what the Duke looks like in a time before, you know, photographs and things. So that's fair. But yeah, you're right. In his final kind of reveal scene, he does come in. The Duke comes back. Now, this is what I didn't understand. Why does the Duke, you know, he basically says, well, I've got to stop this. We don't want Claudio to die. So they develop this plan where another prisoner is going to die who looks like Claudio, and they'll use his head and things like this. Instead of just putting the hood, you know, saying, oh, by the way, I'm not really a friar, I'm the Duke, he then has to like leave and stage a return as the Duke, like for it to be believed that it is the Duke. He can't just say, you know, ta-da, it's been me all along, you know. He's got to leave and make an entrance as the Duke.
So there is a little bit that we probably need to cover before we get to that part. Sure. Still, so we need to go over basically, I guess then this is when Angelo says, like, all right, kill Claudio, right? Like,
yes, so that's the plan, kill Claudio. Yeah. And bring me his head.
Yeah, after the bed trick. So he basically just goes back on his word with Isabella.
Yeah, so this is where, and this is the third time I've said this, but this is where we really step up Angelo's villainy, you know, because now it's like, well, she did have sex with me. Well, she didn't, but he thinks she did, but he was raped. So that's a separate issue. But, you know, he then says, well, I'm going to go back on my word anyway. We're still going to kill Claudio and bring me his head, because that's what a real villain would say, essentially, you know.
Yeah. But slightly later, it turns out this pirate that looked just like Claudio just happened to die. And so they end up taking his head instead of Claudio's, plus some other prisoners that no one really cares about. But
Okay, I'll let you finish first, then I'll ask you something.
Yeah, about the other prisoner, I just like his scene, because I think it was the provost and maybe Lucio or the executioner. Anyway, they go and talk to that other guy, and they're like, all right, you got to come with us. It's your time to die. And he's like, no, I'm too hungover.
Yeah, basically, I've been drinking all day. I'm not going to do it. But if that's funny, right?
What's crazier is that it works.
Yeah, they're just like, well, you know, you're not fit for life. You're not fit for death. What are we going to do with you, you cheeky scamp? And they just let him go, you know?
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous. So apparently he drinks all the time, which, you know, if that trick's working for you, I guess, why would you not continue to do that? Like, he's been there for years and they've never executed him because he's always drunk. So apparently that... Why are they giving him the alcohol in prison? You know, I don't understand.
I don't know. There's a lot of questions I have about that. Why did they need to kill him as well? Like, his whole thing wasn't important to the overall story.
No, so this is that was the question I was going to ask you. Why is he in the play? I mean, as funny as he is, they say, well, we'll kill him, and then it's not really clear why they need to kill him, because they were going to use his head and they were going to shave the hair and shave the beard and say, oh, it's Claudio. His last wish was to shave his hair and beard. It's a religious thing, whatever. But then they find, oh, no, there's another someone who's already died who looks actually somehow conveniently exactly like Claudio. We'll just use his head. But then they still kill the other guy. I don't know why they need to do that.
Did they end up killing the other guy still? I mean,
I think they do.
I honestly don't even remember.
I mean, it's almost a moot point. They still have the plan to kill him. And I just don't know why. Like, I don't know. He's called Barnardine. I don't know why he's really, you know, in the play, as funny as he is. His system works for him. I need to go back and double check if they actually do kill him or not. But it's almost, as I say, it's almost irrelevant. We don't see him again. You know, he only really pops up in Act 4. But
yeah, I just it's 4-3 when they discuss this. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why they have this system in place. It's a strange thing to, I don't know. It's a very strange scene, but it's funny.
It is. And it is actually, there's still more that happens in this scene. Like, so the Duke tells Isabella, like, this has already been set up. He knows that Claudio is going to be alive, but the Duke lies to Isabella and says that your brother was killed.
He does. So before I even get to that, I know why we're confused about whether Bernardine dies. I found the quote. When they leave, they say, let's use the head of this other guy. And then the last thing the Duke says is, but what persuade this rude wretch willingly to die? So we don't then see what happens, but there is the idea that they are still going to try to kill him at some point.
Yeah, the Duke isn't probably going to care much about his life. Not like Claudio's.
Yeah. And you're right. I don't know why the Duke...
That's when it gets really strange. And I know that this is like... this is really normal for Shakespeare. He loves doing it himself. And then, like, just having these people show up randomly later and like, oh, they're not actually dead. Yay. But to actually, like, I feel like the Duke is kind of like him as a character.
Mm.
Almost.
But is this a fun trick to play on someone? Like, I don't think it is.
No,
like, if I say
it's
to
not.
You, oh, by the way, I've killed your sibling and you're really sad. Just because I then say later, oh, your sibling's really alive. Sure, you're going to be happy. But you're still going to be pretty annoyed with me. You know, I don't think that just fixes everything.
He does give a reason, at least. And it's basically like, well, she'll feel terrible now. But once she feels that or finds out that he's alive, she'll be even happier than if I had just told her right now.
Mm. Well, it's a very utilitarian system of ethics there. I don't know why we needed that. But I had a supposition. I had an idea. Maybe it was to, you know, in the intervening time, it's going to be another day or so. Maybe in case anyone were to question her, she should seem believable. She shouldn't seem like her brother has not just died. You know, it just adds a point of realism, I guess.
That's a fair point. Yeah. You know? If the Duke had actually said that, that would have helped.
Yeah, he didn't say that. I'm just thinking that's the only thing that makes sense to me, you know. Maybe Angelo comes to see her or something and she's happy because she knows her brother's not dead. And then Angelo's like, ah, something's going on here. You know, that's kind of the only thing I can. But I'm writing into that at this point. It's not stated, you know.
That would make more sense. But yeah, when the Duke does that, I'm just like, this Duke is kind of a dick. Like,
yeah, I mean, kind of.
And like, yeah, we're not on Act 5 just yet, but. Basically, he could have just said at the beginning of Act 5, hey, your brother's alive, but he still draws it out.
He still draws it out, yeah. I'm not that keen on the joke, really, because he goes through this charade of dressing up, and he talks to people, he plans a rape of Angelo. You know, he even in the beginning, he wanted to achieve something politically, so he lets Angelo be his scapegoat, essentially, so he doesn't look unpopular, which, again, is not mentioned by anyone. They just think, oh, the kind old joke, but... he does a lot of things I'm not that keen on. He does this emotional trick with Isabella saying that Claudio was dead. You know, he could have fixed things a lot quicker if he really thought Claudio shouldn't die, which I don't know why he thought that, because his whole plan was to make the laws stricter. So now in the first application of that, he's backtracking, you know, and then he feels, well, Claudio should be let to live. Then instead of just saying, well, I'm the joke, let's fix it, he continues with this big charade, emotionally manipulating everyone. He's in his costume, he makes his exit and then re-enters as the joke. There's a lot of nonsense, really.
Halfway through Act 5, he still acts like the brother's dead. And
yeah,
it is so strange to me. Like, I feel like also the Duke, what he's trying to do doesn't make a lot of sense. If you put Angelo in as your scapegoat, you should leave and step back. But basically what he's doing is he's backpedaling this entire time. He's like, okay, we got to get rid of Angelo because I know he's a bad guy. But this isn't going to make the rules any stricter.
No, at the end of the play, nothing is achieved.
I mean, yeah. I mean, he ends up happy still, but
they end up happy. But in terms of the whole point about the changing the laws and all of that, nothing happens there, you know. I guess they expose Angelo as not such a kind fellow, which they originally thought he was a great chap. So I suppose that's some. It's almost as if the whole, but again, this is never stated. It's almost as if the whole play was like a moral test for Angelo. You know, it's like, if I leave and leave you in charge, are you going to mess up? Or are you going to be the good chap we think you are? But again, they never say that, but that's what it's like.
That's how I've seen it acted before, that they try to push it that way. But yeah, the way it's written, just... reading it, no, you might have to cut out those lines if you're acting it yourself.
Yeah, possibly. Or again, just we're my problem with this play is, although I like it, I do feel like a couple of times we're having to almost write something in to like make it make a bit more sense.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, this play does have quite a few plot holes. Yeah. But it's also one of the funniest of Shakespeare's plays to me. So
it is. There's some good funny scenes that we've mentioned. And I guess an audience at the time would have just seen it as a bit of a funny farce. We've got characters dressing up. We've got, you know, mistaken identities. Yeah. We've got lying about the death. And then, oh, no, he's really alive. Isn't it all fine? Oh, we tricked that man into marrying Mariana, which he potentially should have done in the first place. So that's all's well that ends well, essentially. You know, that's a good outcome.
Yeah. So how much of Act 5 do we want to get into? I know you usually don't spoil the ending, but I feel like the ending can be quite important for this one. This
one's tricky because the ending's quite important, and Act 5 is just one massive scene. So it's not as if I can say, well, let's cover scene 1 and not scene 2 or something. I think we just need to... We can say a little bit about it. I think we might as well say, because I think that otherwise people are going to wonder what on earth is going on.
So the Duke shows up. And he meets Angelo. Then there's a whole crowd of people. Isabella comes in to talk with the Duke because she's basically been told by the friar, who was the Duke, that, like, hey, if you come talk to the Duke, things will be okay. But then she tries to talk to the Duke, and the Duke stands up for Angelo. So he's still acting like the Duke and Angelo's a good friend. So making Isabella really fight for...
Yeah, I don't know why he does that.
Situation. Like, I think it's still supposed to make it look completely real. Like, the Duke shouldn't believe this random woman. He should believe his deputy.
But again, that would make sense if they're doing a whole, let's give Angelo enough rope to hang himself with kind of thing. But again, it doesn't seem like they are testing Angelo here. He's just kind of being mean to Isabella and making it really fight for it for no reason.
Yeah, and throughout this, you got Lucio trying to butt in, and the Duke telling him to shut up. And
that's funny. Yeah,
it does keep me chuckling throughout. The play never lost me. It made me want to like really get to the end, except probably for the elbow scene in Act 2. But that still had some funny moments. So they finally. Then ask Mariana to come talk to Angelo and say, like, hey, I slept with you.
And Angelo admits that he knows her from, so he does the right thing here. He admits their past. He doesn't try to hide that. Yeah. I think he's smart enough to know that they know that. But then he says, but I haven't seen her since. Now, and again, it's this thing of the mistaken identity. He knows this woman. So how did he not know it was him he was sleeping with? I mean, turn off the light, I guess. But I feel like, he knows the two women, you know. It's just a little sometimes the identity stuff.
She still followed the same rules that were given. Yeah, yeah. I mean, they still got some of the same. She still followed the same rules. She came through the garden at a certain way. And I think that makes sense. They did also ask if there were any like passwords that need to be said. But I guess when there's like no lights and no the candle's already out, like no electricity, of course. So
yeah, I mean, I suppose why would you think you were being tricked? You know, he had no reason to think he was being tricked. But again, if I say to someone, you know, do you want to sleep with me? You're literally right here, right now. And they say, that's grand. I'll come back later and we'll do this whole espionage thing.
You want to do it at the office?
That's a little bit weird, you know.
Well, I think they were at like the office then.
Oh, well, I don't know if they could have gone home or what, but it just, you know, I would have had my guard up a little bit. Why have we got to do this sneaking around at night with the lights off and everything, you know, that, but he just goes along with that. He doesn't think he's being tricked. He's a simple enough fellow in that sense. And now, of course, no, you're right. Mariana now says, well, it was me you slept with, and that is revealed then.
Yes. But then it gets confusing a bit more here because everyone's bringing up the friar. Like, he's the one who's been talked about throughout this entire scene, and they're like, all right, we need to get this guy in to clear up this situation. And the Duke's like, all right, I'm just going to leave it to you, Aeschylus.
He just kind of weirdly leaves, having just made his grand entrance, and then the friar appears, and it's like, at this point, I'm struggling to believe it.
Yeah, I mean, sure, he has the hood up, and throughout this, like, finally, then... Yeah, finally then the Duke gets revealed. And like, I don't know.
I think Lucio is panicking more than anyone else at this point.
Yes.
He's been literally just been saying about how the friar was bad-mouthing the Duke to the Duke, who is also the friar, you know. So once he realizes
he's turned pale a little bit and is probably wanting to like walk away. But
yeah,
finally, after all of that, Angelo basically is told, you have to marry Mariana, and Angelo's like, no, kill me, please, I don't actually want to marry this woman. And the Duke then makes him go off and get married. They come back later, and I'm skipping a little bit, but then when they come back, the Duke says, all right, Angelo, you're going to be killed now. she got what she wanted, to be married to you. And then
5 minutes.
Yeah. Like, what?
Well, she gets some of his property now or something, right? There's like
an he would have been able to.
Yeah.
But that's the benefit. He begs for his life. Right. She begs for his life. Isabella begs for his life. And he's not killed in the end. He's just forced to live with her for the rest of his life. I don't know. He might commit suicide after this play's done. That, who knows?
And again, now Shakespeare loses me because, like, what? A punishment worse than death is having to put up with your wife? You know, is that what's happening?
I mean, he still pays his pound of flesh, I guess.
Sure, I don't like that the women, and maybe it is a literary stereotype about, like, you know,
don't take that out of context.
Warm-hearted, you know, women or something, but they don't want him to be killed, even though he did the wrong thing. Like, they should want him to be killed. They shouldn't be so compassionate, you know?
Yeah.
They should say, well, Mariana should say, you left me for 5 years without marrying me. And fair enough, like, she might not want him to die if she does really love him. That's fine. But Isabella then is like, no, don't kill him. Well, he wanted to blackmail you into sex. Like, you should. Yeah. And
he's taking the high road, right?
And he thought he killed your brother. Like, as far as he knew, he had killed your brother. And he wanted his head presented to him, you know.
And actually,
he's not a good guy.
We still believe that Claudio's dead.
At this point.
Anything about Claudio up until this point.
And Isabella just says, well, and this is really strange. She says, at least my brother did the crime he was committed of. Angelo didn't, because he didn't really have sex with me. He had sex with Matt. So it's almost like they're using here now some kind of outcomes moral system. You know, like, technically, Claudio did break the law in a very minor way. Whereas technically, Angelo didn't, because he didn't actually have sex with Isabella in the end. Only because they tricked and swindled and raped him. But she's essentially saying, because of the outcome, regardless of his intentions, we should just let him live.
I'm trying to think, is anyone a good person in this play? Juliet?
I think Claudio was fine. Like, I don't think Claudio intended on doing anything wrong.
Actually, earlier we didn't talk about it, but he does beg for his sister to, like, do it.
He does, yeah. And I suppose if we consider, obviously for us today, that you would say, well, it's like, you know, his life's in the balance. Of course he does. But given how serious her losing her virginity and everything would have been at the time, it is quite bad that he does beg her to do that, I suppose. You know, he's not going to make a sacrifice for her, but he wants her to do it for him. So, yeah.
Claudio's character was kind of strange there, because he goes from accepting death to the next page saying, no, don't let me die. Do this.
Yeah, it's a weird flip. He just accepts it, and she's like, okay. And then he's kind of like, what? Okay. You know,
She's like, hell no, you beast, something like that.
Yeah. So when it seems like he's happy enough to die, I think the fact that she's, you know, okay with that, and she's not like, no, I'll do it, then he's like, well, hold on a second, you know, I'm gonna change my mind here. But is anyone a good character? Like, is there anyone we consider morally good now, apart from maybe Juliet, who doesn't really do anything in the play?
Yeah.
And Lucio, like, a lot of... Lucio goes around lying about a lot of people, really, with no motivation other than a bit of fun. There's no one that's really, like, morally good.
No, not really. Maybe, like, if we cared about, like, the provost or Elbo, maybe they're okay.
Sure, they might be. We don't know that. You know, we don't see anyone do anything great.
I mean, they do seem to be, like, the moral center, because they're the ones who are like, hey, don't kill Claudio. They talk to Angelo about it, and, like, they go around saying, like, I really wish that he wouldn't die. This is too strict.
Yeah, you're right. Some of the kind of minor characters do say that, but... we don't see a lot. I mean, even Mariana was happy to be complicit with the rape and everything. So, you know, she's not good either. Isabella goes along with that. I don't think any of them are morally good in that sense. Basically, apart from, as you say, maybe some of those minor characters, not really anyone else. It's difficult to find any good people in this play.
Yeah, yeah. And so here's where we get to the actual ending, where there are... like, clear spoilers. We've been sort of spoiling it throughout, but finally they reveal that Claudio's alive.
Yes.
But Isabella has no lines after that, after she begs for Angelo's life. She doesn't even get to...
she has no, like, lines. And nor does Claudio. Claudio doesn't speak either.
Does he not? Okay.
No, they just kind of mention that he's alive and they bring him on. So, like, if you were an actor playing him, you would appear at this point, but he doesn't speak.
Like, yeah, it's just the Duke speaking throughout most of this.
Yeah, it's just the Duke wrapping up with his kind of his speech that, you know, as far as he's concerned, everything has worked out fine. He has caused a lot of people a lot of problems with his political ambition, I guess, to like, I don't know, he gets the last word. Like, I think that the play thinks the Duke's a good guy, and that's what I struggle with.
Yes, because he's the one, he's supposed to be like Paris, I guess, from Romeo and Juliet or something like that. Like, yeah, he tells like Angelo he has to be married. Then he also tells Lucio he has to get married to the prostitute that he knocked up. Then he also says, Isabella, you're going to marry me. Like, okay, she has no say in getting married to you. You just make this woman marry you. And she has no lines. So this is really interesting from a director's standpoint. So how do you have Isabella react to this at the end? Like, I've seen two different versions. One where Isabella's like content with it, and another where Isabella actually like shows regret on her face.
And I think both are valid because it's not stated anywhere.
It's not.
Strangely, the closing interaction is between the Duke and Lucio. And he goes on about, you know, I'm going to whip you and hang you and all this because Lucio is a bit of a scamp. And that's funny, but it doesn't really wrap up any of the, like, the story. You know, like when Claudio comes in and Juliet sees him, neither of them speak about it. You know, maybe you have them over, you know, sharing a private moment in the corner of the stage, hugging and making up, but they don't speak to the audience, you know.
Yeah, there's no falling action with Claudio and Isabella.
What is your thought on Escalus? Because we said he's kind of Angelo's deputy. Nothing really happens with him at the end, does it?
I don't remember. I mean, I know the last thing I remember with him was that he was supposed to be left in charge when the Duke left to go change into the Friar. But
he sort of goes under the radar in the sense that he's complicit with Angelo, but he's not the prime mover, so he's just kind of let him be, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, he talks back to Angelo. He never did anything necessarily wrong. And who was the one? Was it the provost that was told, like, by the Duke as the Friar, like, don't let Claudio die? Here's this letter from the Duke with his symbol on it.
So the Duke does take some action there. Instead of just saying, look, I'll let you know in a secret, I'm really the Duke, he does this whole big thing where he gives him a letter and says the Duke's coming back in a day or two.
So I think, like, the provost is, because he follows what the Duke says, like, everything's fine. But yeah, as long as you do what the Duke says, you'll be fine throughout this play.
Yeah, but again, does that make the provost morally good? Because technically he broke his oath and his instructions by the deputy of the city in order to follow the Duke's advice. So it's like he does the right thing by accident. Like, they could have gone the wrong way. If a random friar says to you, stop doing your duties and just do a different thing, like, that could go badly for you as well, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that you could just have a friar like ruin everything, like Romeo and Juliet. But
yeah, you know, so it's... It's difficult to say. I almost want to ask the question, and I guess, look, with any piece of literature, we shouldn't ask this, but what was the point of the play? You know, like, we just see some things happen, and then, you know, the Duke still hasn't tightened up on the laws, Claudio's back where he started. What was the point?
I mean, Claudio still gets to marry the woman he wanted to.
Sure, but I think he would have done that anyway if they'd left him alone. You know, that's the thing. Like, he had every intention of marrying her.
Well, if not for Angelo, like, Angelo's the one who was going to kill him. But I guess if the Duke didn't leave in the first place, everything would have been fine.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. If the Duke had not left and had just, you know, if everything had continued in the status quo, everything would have been fine. Or if the Duke had revealed himself at any earlier stage in the play, instead of just emotionally playing with everyone, testing Angelo, Isabella, Claudio, everyone, you know. And for this reason, I see the Duke as quite nefarious, but I don't think that was not Shakespeare's intention. And I should stress, the happy ending is that the Duke makes all these decisions and everyone gets married and it's fine and he gets the last word, you know.
Such a tragedy for Isabella. She was going to become a nun, right? Now she can't because she's going to be married to the Duke.
Yeah, and she doesn't even get to react to that. So it's strange, man. It's very strange. And the Duke has a kind of deus ex machina. You know, in the sense that he comes in and does the reveal. You know, he's the joke at the end, and I'm going to just fix everything. Kind of from the moment of that reveal, he just goes into like fixer mode. He's like, I just decree all this stuff is going to happen, and we're all happy because I say so.
So I would say, like, the point of the play, it's not for the characters in this case. I'd say it's more for the morals that it can teach you. That's what I would say the point of it is, and why people should read it. So, like, it goes over what justice means, what mercy is like, has you question, like, different types of government, things like that.
It does. I think it leads us to ask ourselves some questions, but because I don't think anyone in the play is particularly morally good, I don't think the play directly teaches us anything. I think it just maybe lets us ask some questions, which we can kind of take away ourselves, you know. So in that sense, and to be fair, I should clarify, you know, for anyone studying this one or whatever, it is a fun one to read because of the little bits of humor, and, you know, you do want to finish it. It is an enjoyable play. I do like all of Shakespeare's comedies. They're my favorite plays of Shakespeare's, you know. So
I'm the opposite. Half the comedies are good, most of the tragedies are good.
Yeah, this was the first thing I knew about you was that you didn't like some of his comedies. The first thing I was informed about you by PJ. But yeah, look, it happens, you know. I even like the comedies that aren't that great. Maybe I just like comedy, you know. Tragedies I like as well. The histories, you know, the less said the better, I think.
yeah I mean, we agree on that.
so
I think what's us right one thing. The most important things we need to discuss, though, is the title of the play, Measure for Measure. What does it mean to you throughout this? I have my opinion, but I want to hear yours first.
Okay. It does come up. There's that moment that you love to happen in a movie or something where they mention the name of the play and you get the, there we go. But it's kind of mentioned in, like, you know, this is what's happening, you know, deed for deed, measure for measure. It's this idea that essentially, like, I wasn't thinking about it as I read until they really mention it, which is near the end. It's quid pro quo, right? It's, you know, we get the outcome based on the things we do, measure for measure, act for act, kind of, you know, this good thing. You get repaid in kind for what you've done, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, you're saying more like a karma thing in this case.
I don't even know if I want to go as strong as a karma. I just saw it as a kind of, you know, here's the actions you've done and here are the consequences, basically, you know. I mean, what do you take from it?
So kind of looking at it from the way the society was at this time. So this is when, right after Queen Elizabeth the First passed away, right? That was 1603.
Yeah.
This was 1604 when James the First was taking over. This is right when the religion was changing throughout, like Protestant, Catholic, within England. So for Measure for Measure, it seems to come from more of the biblical sense, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Mm-hmm. So there is that idea of, like, we should get revenge for what's happened to us to an extent, but then...
Yeah, okay, yeah.
But then there's also the other side of it when you take a look at the New Testament, when it's like, you need to turn the other cheek. There is no measure for measure. In that case, spare the rod in a way, right?
Yeah. So you're taking it to be more of a
Christian
performance.
Sense.
Yeah, yeah. Perform a measure based on the measure that was performed to you, essentially. It's, yeah.
Yeah. Kind of like, don't do measure for measure.
Yeah, fair enough.
It's kind of what it's teaching us, I feel. Yeah.
Do you think the play is the play teaching us that, or is that something that we have to then discuss and deliberate on and kind of think for ourselves? Like, I struggle to think that the play directly teaches us anything, you know?
So from the way the play is, it feels like it's meant to be read from what we were saying from Shakespeare's perspective, is that the Duke is a good guy.
Yeah.
So he's the one who actually has the mercy in this. He's sparing Angelo. Like, oh, I could have killed him. I could have killed Lucio, but I'm not going to do that. So there will be mercy.
Yeah, Claudio, you know, survives as well. So the guys don't, nobody really die. Well, not nobody dies, but none of the main characters die, you know. And there's still a head that they do offer up from someone who did die, but we're not entirely sure whether
natural.
Bernadine. Yeah, yeah. We're not sure whether Bernadine will or will not be killed at some point. His position is, ends as it began. We're going to try to persuade him to die eventually. And, you know, we don't see him again.
Probably,
so,
like, liver failure or something.
Yeah. So in that sense, yeah, I suppose we don't have an eye for an eye, really.
Which is kind of what Angelo feels like he was doing. If you break the law, then you're going to be punished for it.
Yeah. Fair enough. I think that is, you know, if there is an outcome, it's that, because there's definitely not much of an outcome in the world of the characters, because, you know, the Duke's whole ambition of changing the laws and things doesn't go anywhere. So that's, yeah, you know, pointless. But I think that there's nothing else I want to say about this one. Is that we covered mostly everything?
I feel like there's some things we could still discuss. There's only one more that I want to, and it's kind of quick, kind of with like the irony of Angelo's name, right?
Yeah.
Supposed to be like Angel.
And he's
so throughout the play, they do talk about angels. They do say, they do use the Bible around him. So mm-hmm. you could read into that a little bit, but also like with like wolf in sheep's clothing, he's not acting much like an angel.
Right? Yeah. He's the devil in angels, you know, name essentially.
Yeah. And so I might just end on like one of my favorite quotes throughout. So talking about Angelo, his glassy essence, like an angry ape, plays such fantastic tricks before high heaven as make the angels weep, who with our spleens would all themselves laugh mortal.
Mm-hmm. Angelo makes the angels weep.
And laugh.
And laugh. Well, there we go. I mean, I suppose very last question is, I think I know the answer to this, because I think we've both said, I did like the play. You liked it as well, right? Yeah.
Oh, so, yeah. I very much enjoy it. It might have actually gone up maybe one spot in my ranking, but we shall see.
Nice. Well, thank you very much for joining me on this episode of Playboys. We're gonna do another, aren't we? What do you want? Do you want to reveal what the next one is going to be?
So I think the other one that we were agreeing upon might have been the Moorish play.
It is indeed. We are going to do Othello.
That would be good. It is one of the best tragedies.
I have read it. I've read them all, but I don't really remember much about it. So it's going to be a fun reread for me.
Yeah. I think there's a lot you can get out of it. And there's a lot of deep characters to it, deeper than here. And some characters who are actually good, some who are not. But I think there is more also black and white with the characters in Othello, except for maybe Iago.
Well, yeah, Iago's the famous kind of more or less all I remember from the play. Okay, well, we'll get to that next time. This has been Measure for Measure. Thanks.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.